Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday morning. It is the 20th of September. Very nice to have you here. Thank you very much for listening and for making us a part of your day. It means a lot to us. Let me introduce our group, and we'll also remind you that you can be a part of the program. All you have to do is write to us, panel at wamc.org, panel at wamc.org. Simple as that. Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Akarios-Kelly joins us. Good morning, Vera. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. I'm happy. The sun is shining. What could be wrong?
Well, we're not used to having happy people in the studio, but
well,
that's fine. We'll
I try
take
to
it.
Be happy.
Yes, no, you are. You are happy, and I hope it's infectious. A preceptor in public speaking for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson joins us. Good morning, Terry. How are you?
I'm good, Joe, and I'm happy to be here, just like Vera, and I appreciate her positive attitude today.
Yes, nothing wrong with that. Now, a man beaming sunshine, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
We're just not saying where those beams are coming from, Joe. I do note that they wrote a play about me, apparently, happiest man in the world.
Yes, so, yes. Well, so, it's... You brought it all together, Bob. Thank you very much. It's if we rehearsed it. Semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer at Times Union, for the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz is here. Hi, Jay. How are you?
Hi, Joe. I am happy, but that could turn on a dime as soon as we start talking about stuff. So,
yeah,
let's
turn
have at it.
On a dime indeed. All right. Well, again, we welcome your letters, panel at wamc.org, panel at wamc.org. And we'd love to hear from you. We get to as many letters as we possibly can. And, you know, just because you write to us doesn't mean we're guaranteed to do it, but we do try. I'll say that. Let's talk about Canada. This is a wild story, concerning and wild. The allegation was a bombshell that India had been involved in the killing of a Canadian citizen on Canadian soil in the month of June. Canada's prime minister leveled the charge Monday, and an all-out diplomatic war soon followed. Canada pressed its allies to come together to challenge India, with statements of concern issued in Washington and Australia. India moved to expel a top Canadian diplomat in a tit-for-tat move, and Indian officials lined up to air grievances with Canada. But behind the plunge in relations to what officials and analysts called the lowest point ever were years of diplomatic tension. In New Delhi's eyes, Western nations, most notably Canada, have stood idly by as extremist Sikh groups, including the one led by the murdered Canadian citizen, have supported a sectionist cause that threatens the Indian state. Indian officials have accused their counterparts in Canada, Britain, and the United States of inaction as the diaspora mobilization from this independent nation that Sikh sectionists want to establish in the Punjab region has vandalized Indian diplomatic missions and threatened Indian diplomats. That from the New York Times. Vera, let us begin with you.
So there are so many things we can talk about. At the core of at the core of this issue is the fact that it looks like President Narendra Modi, a Hindu nationalist, has given orders, authorized the assassination of a Canadian citizen. Now, we're all awaiting more details on this, but clearly Trudeau has communicated with Western allies, in particular with the U.S., the Brits, and the Australians on this issue, because the Canadians, just like the other countries I mentioned, host the largest Sikh diaspora. Diaspora is the term for, you know, the ethnic community that lives outside of their homeland. So about 800,000 Sikh Canadians or Sikh live in Canada. They are pretty well organized, as well as those that live in the United States, the UK, and Australia. If, in fact, further evidence is disclosed on this assassination, we have a new chapter in Indian foreign policy. parallel to be established to what President Erdogan of Turkey has done in terms of authorizing assassination of ethnic Kurds in Europe. So if, in fact, Prime Minister Narendra Modi authorized the assassination of a Canadian Sikh citizen, we have a major global crisis at our hands. India has increasingly turned nationalistic. Modi is focusing on isolating ethnic and religious minority communities. We might have noticed that Muslims and Christians and now Sikh have been targeted in various parts of India. The Sikh population predominantly lives, they live in other states as well, but we're looking at Punjabi state within India, which is in northern India. Going back to colonialism, we can thank the British for having segregated the Sikh population between, now what is now Pakistan and what is now India. So this particular ethno-religious movement, the Khalistan independence movement by the Sikh, was very active and quite violent in the 80s and early 90s. Now, they haven't really been extremely well-organized or powerful in India at all. The center of power was in the diaspora. However, it looks like Modi is trying to strengthen his position by targeting minority communities and reinitiating hostilities towards the Sikh population. Now, Trudeau is also an interesting story because his general support from the Canadian electorate is shrinking. He's not as popular as he once was, and this is an opportunity for him to shore up his, credibility inside the country to say, hey, if another country encroaches on the rights of Canadian citizens, I will confront them as hard as I can to protect the rights of free speech in Canada, and I will communicate out to my strongest allies and those countries that also have a large Sikh minority community. To wrap up my comments, this is a major problem for the idea that Biden had to bring Modi and India into the larger fold to separate India further in terms of economic, relationships with Russia and to strengthen support and engagement with the Ukrainians.
Bob Griffin.
Yeah, Vera, thank you. Those were, I thought, some really compelling issues. A couple of other issues I'll toss on the table, Joe. This has some really serious potential ramifications as far as our China policy. So India plays a huge role in sort of our efforts to counter China's expansionist policies in and around Asia and the Pacific Ocean. So when we start to think about a reaction to this situation, understand that there's the lens that Vera just spoke about, but there's also this lens of what's occurring with our continued tensions with and growing tensions with China. When I was looking into this article, I found it interesting too that the issue in Punjab and this whole independence movement was directly related to the assassination of Indira Gandhi. So there is a history of violence here. I thought what Vera did was really important, though, is that she put her finger on this is going to be another excuse for Modi to amp up his own internal security services and use this as a rallying cry for his Hindu nationalism. Well, what's interesting to me, though, is that while in the past he's sort of poked at Pakistan you know, this is a minority group within India, which makes it actually easier for him to demonize given the history. So I expect there to be further crackdowns within India, and that's something I think we need to watch. And to give you a sense of how bad the blood is between India and Canada, and Canada is not normally known for sort of their aggressive behavior towards others. I mean, they usually their reputation is sort of a go along, get along. You know, it's not certainly not like the United States. It's they're certainly a much more peaceful people. I would say, but the Trudeau's plane had some sort of technical issue, which I find fascinating. And he was stuck in a hotel after the G20 for two additional days, refusing offers by the Indian government to lend him a plane. Now, there's all sorts of questions that I have about that, like how could the prime minister's plane break? also, why Canada couldn't get another plane there within the period of time. But also it shows you, though, that the decision for the security services in Canada was that it was safer for their prime minister to hole up in a hotel for a couple of days than it was to accept an offer of help from the Indian government. So this isn't one of these situations that's going to go quietly into the night. This is going to have some longer term implications.
Fascinating. Jay?
Yeah, I think Vera really got into the geopolitical complexity of this. My initial reaction and my continuing reaction to this is that I'm kind of glad that Trudeau said something about this. That, you know, as we were talking before, I was reminded of the incident some years ago when Erdogan's bodyguards beat up Kurdish protesters right in Washington. And it was, you know, I remember thinking, where is my country on this? This is not how, I mean, this is a free speech issue. This is, you know, it's kind of felt to me to go to the heart of being on American soil should, imply some rights and protections. On the other hand, I'm, you know, well aware that, you know, we do things overseas that are unsavory and, you know, or that we justify after the fact. So, you know, the one that comes to mind, of course, is bin Laden. You know, we felt it was justified to go over and assassinate him, and we did. But I was glad to see that Trudeau said, there's a line here, and you don't come to our country and kill people on Canadian soil. It's like the nicest country, one of the nicest countries in the world. There's such nice people. I spent a lot of time there in the 80s. And, you know, the idea that this would happen, and I think that, you know, all the other political and geopolitical considerations aside, I think that's a fundamental thing that really strikes a chord with people. And I think it's going to strike a chord with Canadians who are just going to say, thank you for doing that.
Jay, do you think this has anything to do with our lack of official reaction to the Saudi Arabian situation?
The U.S. reaction?
Yeah. Right. That we sort of gave a tacit, it was a slap on the wrist, and now we're best friends again with the Saudis.
Yeah, I had Khashoggi on the list as well of, you know, things that we and the international community, you know, to a large degree just kind of said, tisk, mm-hmm. But that's about as far as it went. Yeah. And, you know, for a Canadian president to be the one who takes the strong reaction here about an infringement of rights on their soil is it's heartening that somebody did. I hope maybe, you know, this is a model for some other world leaders to say, don't do this.
It's actually not the first time that the Canadians have been pushing back against India. It was also related to the Tamil minority when, you know, the Indian government was extremely violent towards the Tamils. And a lot of Tamils, you know, Tamil nationalists live in Canada. So the Canadians and the Indian government have had a history of migratory patterns of ethno-religious minorities from India to Canada, and then these sort of, you know, well-organized diaspora communities that are trying to organize and push back. What's really interesting is how serious Modi takes the organizing of the Sikh minority or this particular group of the Sikhs, because what he was most offended about was the idea that Sikhs in Canada organized an independence vote, right? I mean, in essence, what does it matter if, you know, the Sikhs in Canada have a hold a vote and bring it to the U.S. or the Australians or the Sikhs in the U.K. and the majority of those residents and citizens in those countries vote in favor of Sikh independence in the region of Punjab. You know, it's a very symbolic gesture. But the fact that Modi pushed so hard and sent an assassination team, from what it sounds like, to Canada as a reaction to this organizing, shows that he is extremely nervous and angry about symbolic acts, and he knows very well he can use that to fortify a Hindu nationalist unity in India against all minority communities. And that is an illiberal development, even further from what, you know, how we have criticized the Indian regime. So this is not a good sign for democracy in India.
I wonder if it'll make a difference. Am I cutting you off?
Yes. That's okay. We have to go to a break, and then we got to get Terry in. So,
okay.
And I promise you're still on the show, Terry. You didn't get...
okay.
We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday morning. Very nice to have you with us. We are talking about Canada's startling claim that is punctuating tension with India over separatists and the allegation that India was involved in the killing of a Sikh leader in Canada. We have gone around the room, but we have not heard from Terry Gibson yet. Terry, good morning.
Good morning. I really enjoyed listening to the conversation. I think a lot of great points were made. I think this is not only a warning to those who want to see democracy succeed, not only in India, but I think it's a warning to those that want to see democracy succeed in the world. I think anytime you have an authoritarian leader like Modi using religion to move their agenda forward, you are moving into very troubled territory for maintaining a true democracy. And I worry about that happening in our country and other countries as well. I was also really happy to see Prime Minister Trudeau step forward and speak very vocally about this and take a hard position. I think that's the type of leadership that we need in the world today if we intend to preserve democracies. I'd like to see that kind of leadership here in the United States. Right now, clearly, Joe Biden has decided to stay relatively silent on this issue. And while you can understand politically why that choice might be made, the vision of him fist bumping the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia comes to mind when I kind of think about how we handle these things in the United States. And I think that's going to be problematic moving forward for both Joe Biden and for our democracy. I think it's important to realize that India is now the most populated country on the planet, and it is therefore positioned to place a lot of leverage on a lot of smaller countries, including the United States. And the United States needs India's support for so many reasons, both economically and militarily, but other countries do too, and some of our enemies need their help as well. This is a really tricky situation for anyone in a leadership position to maneuver through, and I think that it is just the beginning of what is going to continue as long as Modi and other authoritarian leaders remain in power.
We've all touched on it, and I'm interested, Vera, let's begin with you. We'll start the cycle again, but what should the United States be doing? Terry talked about the muted response from President Biden. Should that be more?
So I think there's a difference between how the Canadians and how the U.S., the British, and the Australians should respond. The Canadians should be out front because they have made the accusation. The other three countries ought to work very closely with each other to figure out a joint strategy to warn India to never consider doing anything like this in the other three countries. For the simple reason that the consequences will be extremely painful in terms of economic sanctions or other reactions. This is a diplomatic issue now for the other three countries. It needs to be discussed. A joint strategy has to be developed. Now, for Biden, this is complicated because he obviously would like to have improved relations with India for a number of reasons. This is a major slowdown on that path because, he cannot step away from joining the other allies and critiquing India, but he should probably do this behind closed doors rather than engage in a public performance as the Republicans appear to call for.
Yeah, Vera, I think again you're on target. I actually think it's going to be a more muted response than that. I think we'll hear words about ongoing investigation. We're not going to comment on a matter that's involved in in internal to Canada's legal system, and then some sort of watered down milquetoast comment about appreciating the rights of all people to be independent. I'm going to put a couple of finer points on the comment I made about China, though, Joe. There's this really interesting arms race going on in the Pacific Ocean right now, where China has started to develop a series of naval bases around India. So if you start to think about the Pacific Ocean and then up towards Africa and into the Middle East, the response from India has been to do something similar. So one is called the Pearl Choker, and the other is the Diamond Necklace. I don't develop these names. I just read about them. But when you look at this situation, though, you also need to look at the rising tension that is going on in Tibet between China and India right now, and there has been enough news about clashes between actually the military forces of both of the countries, in sort of this perverse way where they're almost coming down to fistfights because of sort of international rules about use of weapons in the area. But I mean, there's a lot of tension. There's an awful lot of tension in that area. So when Vera and the others have talked about the internal workings of India, it strikes me is that this is a move that it's sort of like and I'm not diminishing the actions, but it's sort of like the opening gamut of a larger chess play going on. That this wasn't just a one and done movement. Is that there? This was intentionally done for other reasons affecting the geopolitical game that's going on in that region, which puts us in this really, really awkward position where India has a reputation of sort of thumbing their nose at us when they want to, but then sort of cozying up when they see fit. And right now, given the situation, if you think about this sort of weird axis between China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran, it behooves us in the political scene to make sure that India is coming down on the side of the Western democracies rather than either neutral or sort of pro axis of chaos.
Terry?
Well, I really appreciate Bob's perspective on that. I thought that was very enlightening and thought provoking. And the military aspect of this does concern me greatly. There are lots of nuclear powers that surround India, and that, of course, includes India as well. And there is clearly a struggle for territory there. The action that's happening in the oceans around India, as Bob described, is disturbing as well to see China's aggression on this. But I guess for me, the thing that I just keep coming back to is how a singular religion, a very large religion, is being used to kind of justify so much of what Modi is doing. And I worry that that model could be reflected by other leaders in other countries, and they could see this as something that maybe they should try and do more often, because it may work for them and it may work for Modi as well. I'm also just curious to see how the people, how the citizens of India react to this, and how the news of this is being portrayed in India. I'd like to get a sense of what that is too. Is the messaging in India different than what we're hearing here? I suspect that it is.
Jay?
Yeah, this is probably wishful thinking, but along the lines of what Bob was just saying, what Terry was just saying, sorry. You know, Modi is in office for, I think, another 2 years. And I'm interested to see if Canada is going to release any more information that about their intelligence on this. I mean, he has denied that they did this. That they had a role in this. And if Canada were to show, look, hey, we have the evidence and here it is. And there's any number of reasons, I guess, that, you know, we don't get to find things like that out because of revealing methods and sources of intelligence and so forth. But, you know, if Modi is proven on the shown on the world stage to be a liar, how that plays in India, how that plays everywhere else, allows him to be separated from India on this, essentially, that it's not the credibility of India. It's not the policy, you know, it's not about Indian policy. It's about, you know, here's a guy who lies and he lies pretty blatantly to the world. That could kind of change the dynamics here, that, you know, a lot of the issues about whether or not we're isolating India or insulting India. No, the beef is with Modi. If we or Canada. Mm-hmm.
So, Jay, who's the GOP frontrunner right now? Talking about liars and effect.
Yeah, right. I know. Well, you know, we're a whole thing unto ourselves. So, but I do think if you can embarrass somebody on the world stage, which may be another reason why you don't do it, you don't embarrass. Yeah.
Well, and that's exactly why. That's why I don't think we're going to do a heck of a lot, because you embarrass them, and then all of a sudden, you know, it becomes personal, and that's a. That's an even more difficult situation. Terry, I think your comments, if I could go back to watch the news, if you start to see a lot more articles about Indira Gandhi and the Golden Temple attacks, hearkening back to truly some savagery from the Sikh separatists, you'll start to, you know, that's what I'm looking for coming out of the Indian press.
I mean, yeah, there is a lot of Indian nationalism for sure.
Yes.
And also remember that Modi was once banned from entering the United States because of religious, ethno-religious, violence and encouragement and nationalistic
terrorism.
Language, encouragement for, you know, carrying out violent attacks against minority communities. So this is a pattern that he's been involved in. We knew that about him before he became Prime Minister of India. Now he's doing it as Prime Minister. I mean, this is a pattern that has existed for a couple of decades. I mean, he rode this wave of ethno-national religious, you know, violence to the throne in India. And so the population is familiar with it. They have used propaganda on the sort of Hindu nationalism niveau for a couple of decades. And here we are. Now it looks like that he has sent his henchmen abroad. I mean, this is not an unusual pattern for authoritarian types, to be honest, because they like to control what the diaspora of a minority community does abroad. And that's where we established, you know, Jay and I, we talked about the Kurdish communities globally.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We have quite a few. We'll get to those when we return. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel. panel discussion. Jay has his face in his hands. I'm sorry if I caused that. Welcome back to the program. Wonderful to have you with us. All right, let's get to some of these letters that we have. Bonnie says, no one is even mentioning the elephants in the room. Many are horrified by U.S. friendliness towards India, for our own ends, of course. Modi has a horrific record of human rights, abuses, repression towards all non-Hindus. Talk about Kashmir. Talk about the dispossessed.
Talk about the targeting of Muslims in Gujarat state, where some 4,000 to 5,000 were slaughtered, right? We have those kinds of bits of information, Kashmir and so on. This is reality. Our national leaders have interactions with even the most hideous leaders in the world. And the reason we have those interactions is because we need to try and have some access to most governments. I mean, there are very few we exclude from that. I mean, earlier, I think in the break, we talked about the relationship with Saudi Arabia. Politics is not clean. International politics is a very difficult business. And as so often is, you know, as it is, it's quite depressing. Human rights most often do not rise to the highest levels. They should be elevated, but the reality is that's not reality out there.
The other piece of this, too, yes, that we need to remember is that we can't do it alone. I mean, if we isolate India and India decides to have some sort of tit-for-tat trade war with us, the impact on our medical supplies is phenomenal. I mean, and this, again, I think is a fundamental problem with we're not building enough at home in order to have even the degree of independence to be able to take a moral position on this. So,
and we can't isolate Russia or Iran or Cuba. I mean, when you think about it, it's not working globally anyways, right?
I mean,
this is like Sisyphus work trying to create these sanctions, and they're very difficult to maintain. Sorry, Bob.
No.
It's one of Bob's words.
Yes. You think about where we are with the world. Is that we have world leaders like the crackpot in North Korea, but then again, I think coming up we're going to talk about our own crackpots in Congress. So I mean, it's a mad world, which is also a really good film.
But we can't be seen as throwing in the towel either. On all that stuff and say, you know, I go back to, I think it was Obama saying, America is the essential nation. And, you know, as I was reading the coverage on some of this, it was people were talking about the United States and everyone else. And we still are that. And we shouldn't kind of surrender that moral brand that we we are still, still known for in some areas. But the realities are, the realities.
Back to the letters. We go to Richard. Go ahead, Terry. Go ahead, Terry.
Well, I thought within this topic here, it's just important to point out, too, that when we're talking about our relationship with India, that Indian Americans are the second largest immigrant group here in the United States. They are a significant part of our population here and significant contributors to our population in terms of economics, in terms of politics. I mean, they're not only here, but they're growing, and it only makes sense to try to build that relationship. By the way, I just wanted to mention too, I do have a lot of Indian citizens in my courses here at Harvard, and we do talk politics and government quite a bit. And for what it's worth, it's anecdotal, but they always laugh in class when we talk about ethics and government and the laws of government, and they just openly discuss how corrupt the government is in India and how it's just common knowledge that you can't get elected unless you accept bribes, and that bribery is just open and common knowledge there. So for what it's worth, I think that perspective is worth considering.
Let us go back to the letters and what you have to say. We have a few minutes before we have to break at the top of the hour. This from Francesca. When you're silenced at home, you go elsewhere and express dissent there, and sometimes that ends up in your getting support from outside powers. So I think that's what India or China or other countries are thinking of when they try to silence overseas dissent by increasingly drastic means, because they do not see the dissent as merely symbolic or of no consequence. Then we go to Sheila, who says, just to clarify what Vera said, the Tamil minority in India was not persecuted by the Indian government. Rather, the Tamils...
Sri Lankan, yep.
The Tamils, who are an ethnic minority in Sri Lanka,
yep,
sought a separate homeland within Sri Lanka and received help for their insurgency from the Tamils in southern India. Most of the Tamils who came to India were escaping persecution in Sri Lanka for their violent uprising and have little in common with Tamils in India. Seems like you two are in agreement on
that. Yeah, we are in agreement. That is a good and excellent detailed clarification. Yes.
We'll move on from that. Pushy writes, as a member of the Indian diaspora in the U.S. and a professor of international affairs at Skidmore College, I can't refrain from a couple of comments. First, the Indian diaspora in Canada is itself quite fractured, as seen in recent attacks on Hindu temples in Canada, presumably from Sikh activists. This actually poses a problem for Trudeau in Canada itself. Keep in mind, he is hugely reliant on the Sikh vote for political survival. Second, if I might say so, your characterization of Modi's domestic policy is not quite accurate. While the BJP's hostility to Muslims is well known, that is far from being the case with Sikhs. There is a huge Sikh population completely opposed to separatism in India itself, and which votes for the BJP. The extremists are mostly in Canada. BJP standing for?
That's, yeah, I don't, I mean, I'm sorry, the BJP, I just know the abbreviation. I can't remember the full name, what BJP stands for. So I mean, in essence, I agree. I think what is happening, what's that?
It's a party.
Yes.
Bharatiya Janata Party. B-H-A-R-A-T-I-Y-A, Janata, J-A-N-A-T-A, a political party in India. Okay, sorry.
This is a very, you know, a Canadian domestic issue in terms of electoral politics. As I mentioned, Trudeau is very interested in reasserting his commitment as a strong Canadian prime minister. And he also rides on politics of, you know, attracting ethnic minority voters to his ticket. And in India, I would say, you know, currently, maybe one could say that the BJP has focused on attacking Muslims as the sort of minority of choice. But I think the next minority of choice, well, we have seen attacks against Christians, and we will see attacks against Sikhs, I assume. And so what we might see is a use of multiple minority groups as a target. Now, my colleague at Skidmore might have a different position on that, and, you know, certainly that remains to be seen.
Let's go to Richard. I don't intend this as whataboutism. I am afraid that the fact is that when the U.S. undertook its extraordinary renditions beginning some 20 years ago as part of its war on terror and transported the people so captured to extra-legal black sites to Guantanamo, we forever changed the international norms. It is not a coincidence that the leaders of Turkey and India both have cited the need to defend their homelands against quote-unquote terrorists in the incidents that you are discussing. Then we go.
I mean, Joe, we could go even further back than that. I mean, you could start to think about the early 70s with the you know, the assassination of the Israeli athletes at the Munich Olympics, and then the sort of the revenge the Mossad took. But you can go back to our foreign policy even back to the 1800s, where, you know, we. This is something that the country will continue to grapple with, is that what we want to be versus sometimes what our foreign policy is two very different things.
Alba writes, dear panel, can someone bring up the subject of our action to a U.S. citizen, Jamal Khashoggi, killed in Turkey by Arabs? Wish we had the same reaction as Canada in support of our people.
We did touch on that.
Well, I mentioned the fist bump with Biden there. And how I think that's really problematic. I think that we're going to see that in some type of campaign ad next year, that image of the fist bump.
Do you think we'll see the image of the $2 billion in cash that Jared Kushner got to, or is that just too big a pile of money to show in a 30-second
slot? Well, I think we might see it, but
new lens needed. Part,
you know, the visual power of one, I think, is more stronger than the other. I mean, the fact that the Biden administration allowed him to be photographed fist-bumping this murderer, I think, is to me, was just inconceivable. I think it's gonna haunt him and our country for years to come.
All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have many other items to discuss. We will do just that with your help. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. Speaking of help, Ray Graff comes along with news next. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to the panel discussion. Very nice to have you on the program, and we appreciate you being here. We're going to move on to other things, making news, and talk about what's going on in the world. Continue talking about what's going on in the world, and just wouldn't be a day without talking about Kevin McCarthy. So let's do just that. We've been following the story since the weekend on Sunday evening when a group of House Republicans said, "Hey, we've got a plan." And McCarthy on Monday morning said, "I think we can make this plan work." Well, it didn't work. The floor defeat underscored the GOP resistance. The right-wing House Republicans have derailed the Pentagon GOP bill, rebuking McCarthy. Deep Republican divisions erupted on the House floor on Tuesday as a handful of far-right conservatives blocked a Pentagon spending bill from coming up for debate, dealing an embarrassing setback to Speaker Kevin McCarthy as he struggled to round up votes to prevent a government shutdown in less than 2 weeks. I haven't been keeping track, but I'm going to start keeping track of how many times on this program I get to read the term embarrassing setback to Speaker Kevin McCarthy. In a development rarely seen in the House, five Republicans broke with their own party and refused to allow the usually broadly bipartisan military funding measure to be considered, registering their objections to Mr. McCarthy's strategy in an escalating fight over federal spending. It left the chamber paralyzed for the moment with little time before a September 30th deadline to avert a government closure. The stunning setback sent Mr. McCarthy and his lieutenants scrambling for a way forward, both on their year-long spending bills and a temporary funding bill that had already run into a buzzsaw of oppositions from the far right as the speaker faced fresh threats of an ouster from detractors in his own party. I know there's a lot to talk about here, but can I just ask the journalist in the room, Jay, of the Times using the term the stunning setback. Was it really stunning?
None of this is stunning. Setback is what they ought to call it. But yeah, it's, you know, the two, there's probably a million of them, but the two chief dynamics I see here is the idea that McCarthy is now going to turn to the Democrats in kind of a kamikaze sort of act to push something to the floor that is palatable enough to some Democrats that they'll vote on it. And that's how he'll get it. And that'll be the end of his speakership at this point, that it's just, you know, just throw his hands up in the air. Scenario, the idea that really assumes a lot, that the Democrats are going to say, "Oh, sure, we'll help you, Kevin. We'd be happy to be the grown-ups in the room." You know, after, you know, one of the comments in the story today was from one of the more mainstream Republicans saying that the fringe of the Republican caucus was acting like Democrats in being against the military by not helping the Pentagon bill get approved. So, you know, there's no love lost there, and it's going to be a lift for McCarthy to get the Democrats to come along. And the other half of it is. He may well be out of speaker if he makes any overtures that make the Democrats actually vote on a bill with them.
Terry?
Yeah, I'm not sure his speakership is at risk, but it is certainly teetering. What's more, I think, likely is that some type of shutdown will happen because he wants to preserve his speakership and is probably not willing to do the things he needs to do to keep the government running. That's my concern. It is interesting to see this infighting. It's interesting to see Republicans taking a position which does seem to be anti-military, which goes against everything that that party has traditionally stood for. You know, I mean, the truth of the matter is that both parties, every term, you know, vote to pass trillions of dollars to support the military. So it, saying one is anti and one is not is, is really not true based on facts. But facts, of course, never really play into these things. These five characters that are causing him all the trouble, I came across a story in Politico that I thought was interesting, that Ron DeSantis is apparently working with them and trying to find ways to help them put pressure on McCarthy, because McCarthy is an ally of Donald Trump and he's trying to beat Donald Trump. And I thought that dynamic was very interesting. But the messaging coming out from that five there clearly, to me, sounds like we want to shut down the government. Not only that, we want to break the government apart. We want to burn down the government. I mean, they're talking about wanting to slash what was already significant slashes to various government departments significantly. They want to slash them more. And to me, that says that they're really just completely focused on trying to break apart the functional parts of our government and do what would be the next step, which is to corporatize it.
That's really interesting. You know, Terry, it's, I don't think this was at all surprising. I think we could see it coming. Now, I still think there's enough time for the miracle agreement to come, depending on how bad the blood is. I suspect, if I had to lay out a plausible pathway, is that there's a tacit wink and a nod toward the moderate Republicans in I think, is it the Problem Solving Caucus? Is that what they call
them? Problem Solvers,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That they will work across the aisle, independent of McCarthy, to force a closure vote. And again, we're talking just a vote in order to bring a bill to the floor. Part of the Democrats' reaction to this bill isn't anti-military or anti-Department of Defense. It's because it's been loaded up with so much garbage from the Republican and their continued social reengineering attempts of the federal government and in the military. But I wouldn't be surprised that there isn't sort of an attempt to circumvent the far right party, and at the same time appear to or at least make the effort to look like McCarthy's hands are clean of that, and it may not be as difficult to get to the 218 votes as under that scenario. However, the bill that's coming right behind it, though, is so abhorrent to the majority of the Democrats that he wouldn't have enough votes to take it there.
Vera.
Well, the U.S. government works in mysterious ways, and all I can say is everyone knows that it is very dangerous to shut down the U.S. government in terms of the electoral schedule that we're facing. And so I suspect some kind of tortured agreement will emerge to prevent that from happening, because if in fact the government shuts down, it will be clearly the fault of the right wing of the Republican Party. And I think American voters can identify that, and they will suffer the consequences when it comes to not getting paid, not accessing Social Security checks, denying Veterans Affairs support. I mean, there are all kinds of things that could be directly and immediately affected by such a shutdown that would actually be a shock to the system, including, you know, efforts to prevent interest rates from rising. Generally, I think the American public would not be too pleased with a government shutdown, even a partial shutdown. So somehow McCarthy better come up with something, or it might look pretty badly in terms of his future career.
It also shows you the lack of political acumen from DeSantis. You know, the fact that he is advocating for a shutdown at the same time FEMA does not have enough money to pay the disaster relief bill for his state.
Yep.
It's it's fascinating. And he's flailing. I mean, he's trying to figure out a way to stem the whole the Trump coronation. So you have that element. You know, I read a really interesting article about this gang, which I think a Republican referred to as the Dysfunction Caucus, all of whom seem to be looking at positions in either a different branch of government or out of government. So I mean, it is truly a game to them. I think, and I was talking to folks down in D.C. yesterday about this. There's sort of a whistling past the graveyard feeling that I got from folks down there that keep a pretty good pulse on the budget of, well, you know, we think this is just going to be more of the same. But they did admit that this has all of the elements of a complete train wreck that already is out of control. And one of the WAGs said to me, you know, the issue they have is the calendar, even though the calendar can be manipulated, but they're running out of time to be able to do a lot of what they need to do at the most basic level. And Joe, you put your finger on something. This is the easiest bill to bring to the floor traditionally. Okay, this right. isn't getting into any of the hard
stuff,
the hard issues, right. Like, you know, the fact that the far right is okay with children starving in this country.
Yeah, I thought it was kabuki theater for a while, and up until the last few days, probably that you know, I figured, you know, they're just going to do this dance for a certain amount of time. They'll take it to you know, some 11th hour, whatever that is, and then we'll have a deal one way or the other. But increasingly, you know, if you listen to right-wing radio, the people that are, you know, the Mark Levins of the world, the Michael Savages and so forth, you know, they tend to say, I haven't listened to them lately, but they tend to say in situations like this, shutdown's no big deal. You should do it. You should do it. Hold them hostage. Make it happen. This is the only, you know, chance you have to fix everything. And, you know, I could see...
I like your radio voice.
What a great impression. I mean, that's really... You have a second career if you want one.
Well, there we go.
Well, now I know why you're so happy right now, Jay. It's because you haven't been listening to those wackos.
That could be it. And as far as DeSantis goes, if FEMA doesn't have money and can't help Florida, DeSantis, I hate to be this cynical, but DeSantis will just say this is broken government under Joe Biden.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. FEMA's no good.
All right. Let's go ahead, Terry.
I was just going to say one of the things that also just is interesting to me to watch is how the Biden administration is responding to all of this or not responding. I mean, there really isn't a lot coming out of the Oval Office in response to potential shutdown. One part of me thinks it would be good to alert the American people of what this shutdown would look like and how it would harm them directly to make sure they understand the ramifications of it. The other part of me thinks that if Joe Biden says anything about this, he takes ownership of it,
yeah.
And that's the last thing he wants. So it is a tricky place for him to be.
Well, but why would he want to put himself in the center of the circular firing squad? I mean, let him shoot off a few more rounds before he gets involved. And I have started to see that tried and true list of all of the bad things that are going to occur if government mm-hmm. is shut down. I think it's way too premature for Biden to get involved, and we haven't even talked about the fact that this is a GOP-led food fight in the House, and you know, everything that I'm hearing is that they've loaded these spending bills with so much garbage and so many broken promises that there isn't a prayer of getting it through the Senate. So I mean, this is what I'm sort of looking cocked-eyed at this thing going, this is going to be really hard to figure out how to bridge this because the Senate is not going to go along with this.
Bob, that's why we know it's basically performance arts, what we see here, a theater performance, or you call it kabuki theater, Jay, right? Yeah. So What I think Biden should focus on right now, and I have been a little bit disappointed that he hasn't been out front more, is the automobile workers, the union strikes. I think that is something that he's going to get in trouble with if he doesn't step up a bit more. He's holding back too much. He needs to be the man who supports the union effort and get involved or send somebody to be help with the negotiations. I mean, this is essential. Biden could lose union support that way if he doesn't get more deeply involved, and that would be a problem.
But, and meanwhile, Donald Trump is giving up the opportunity to debate next week and is going to be speaking to union workers, making a direct appeal to union workers
in support of abortion rights, too. I mean, so, you know, But I will say this, though. He has sent the secretary in an envoy. I my gut is that he's being told by the union, we don't want your pressure right now. Also, did you notice what happened in Canada yesterday? The Ford plant that was supposed to go on strike cut a deal.
Yes.
So what I'm figuring is that there's going to be some sort of whipsaw bargaining going on. So this thing may be a little bit closer than
I hope so. I hope so. And I do understand that Biden is also a bit of an incrementalist when it comes to union labor strikes, union efforts. And he needs to be the man of the worker, but he doesn't maybe have to be that deeply involved at the moment. And I'm hoping you're right. That's a sign with the Canadian negotiations that they're closer to a deal than we know of.
Terry, what do you think about this question from Peter, who asks, if the Republicans replace McCarthy with Steve Scalise, what would change?
A lot. I mean, a lot. I mean, it, you know, it just you go from a very seasoned political professional who has really devoted his entire life to politics and understands how the game is played. And as much as we hate to give him any credit at all, has made compromises in his political career and is capable of doing it again. Steve Scalise is way out there on the extreme side. And it is, at least in my opinion, going to be much less inclined to strike any deals with Democrats and much more inclined to give the conservative extreme edge of the party what they want.
Anybody else want to add to that? Hearing none, we go to...
Yeah, I'm sorry. Okay. I do. I think we need to tip our hat to
Bob buzzing in late.
To Pelosi, though. I mean, you know, because usually, I don't know where it is, you know, Ken from somewhere always writes in and says, well, what about the far left? But if you think about it...
What the impressions.
Oh, yeah.
Your voice is really good.
Get working on that, Vera.
Worked all week on it. You think about how she kept her caucus in line, and there's just as many philosophical divides on the Democratic side. The leadership was better. Now I'm also intrigued to see what happens with Hakeem, whether he is going to be able to fill her shoes. But talk about a country that didn't realize the capabilities of a really good speaker.
Let's go to this letter from Denise, I think, but it could be wrong. Disney? I don't know. I'm sorry. I apologize. From a listener who says, let's not forget that McConnell has pronounced that a government shutdown is never good for Republicans. Then we go to this from Mark. The only thing worse than the Senate and Congress doing nothing for 16 years is the time we've spent talking about it. Somewhere, someone must do something. You're worried about the government shutting down and the electorate is putting people in power whose goal is just that.
Yeah. I mean, it's true, although I would think that we have some Congress people around us, even in the capital region here in New York. I'm thinking of Molinari and others who must be looking at, you know, I'm sorry, folks, you're on a boat, you're on the Titanic, and there's an iceberg in front of you, and you got a group of people. Think about what this Freedom Caucus has done, okay? You know, Marjorie Taylor Greene is so happy right now that she got kicked out because they look even crazier than she does. Yeah. But they're going to pull down, if you're in a swing district and there's a bunch in New York right now and that really gave Kevin the ability to get to that number, they are so vulnerable right now because they are part of the dysfunction that's screwing up this country.
I hope she goes and sees a Broadway show this weekend.
Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Yeah. Let's see what happens.
Does she vape?
Dukes of Hazzard, the musical? Is that what you're, is that out?
Then we go to Stacey, who says, wait, you're wringing your hands over Biden's fist bump with the crown prince? The murder happened when Trump was president, and his response was to reward the Saudis a high sale of military equipment and technology. Come on. That's from Stacey.
Well, she's not wrong, but the, you know, a picture is worth
well, we have, you know,
words.
Yeah, it's the propaganda machine, right?
Yeah.
We're worried about, because you can easily sort of, you know, boil down a fist pump like into an image of
simple.
Great support for a murderous regime.
Yeah,
I mean,
they made
it's so
a New Yorker
easy
cover.
To tell that story, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes being a germaphobe is a good thing. That's why Trump never fist bumped him.
Thank you, Bob. Then we go to Spencer. Probably worth thinking about this morning. How many people have we assassinated over the last 70 years or so? Close to 50 in the last 25 years alone. And those
yes.
are just the ones we know about. And not all, quote unquote, terrorists either. Anybody remember what we did to the separatist leader who rose to power in the Democratic Republic of Congo in 1961? That from Spencer.
Yeah, I mean, you know, clearly we have a long history in this country of political assassinations abroad. And, you know, I mean, fairly recently in Iran, the General Soleimani was assassinated. So, yeah, we engage in that conduct all the time. We just the argument is just you better not do it on our land. Right. That's the pushback.
Seems to be the argument.
Yeah.
Well, Canada can make the argument. I don't they're not known for the sort of behavior, whereas it's hard for us to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We'll have our last go around with our panelists, and we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll continue after this break and news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Great group this morning. Let me reintroduce them to you. Vera Karius-Kelly is here, Terry Gibson, Bob Griffin, and Jay Jochnowitz. We have a few moments left with them and a few moments left with you. And we welcome your, at least as far as the panel portion of the program. And we would love to hear from you. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So, in the few minutes that we have left, I would like to go to the story about, we were talking about Ron DeSantis' campaign, and I think that the article in the New York Times is the headline, Urgency Grows for DeSantis in Iowa as Trump Looks to Finish Him Off. Despite spending far more time campaigning across the must-win state, Ron DeSantis still trails Donald Trump by double digits. And now Mr. Trump is stepping up his visits to Iowa. And as I mentioned, there will be this debate next week. On paper, Governor Ron DeSantis is doing everything that a Republican presidential candidate should do to win Iowa. He is doggedly crisscrossing the state, visiting 58 of its 99 counties so far, and vowing to make it to all the rest. He's meeting voters at small-town churches, meeting halls, county fairgrounds, and ice cream parlors, heavily courting evangelicals and racking up endorsements from influential faith leaders and local politicians. His PAC is building a formidable get-out-the-vote operation and says it has reserved $13 million in TV ads in Iowa through Thanksgiving. For Mr. DeSantis, who is trailing former President Donald Trump in Iowa by double digits, the state has become a must-win. Mr. Trump, who has campaigned sparingly here, appears to know it. The Trump campaign recently announced that he would visit Iowa five times in the next 6 weeks, including stops on Wednesday in a clear attempt to scupper Mr. DeSantis' bid for the presidency with a resounding victory in the January 15th caucuses, which, by the way, I just want to point out, and call me Captain Obvious, but
that is not far away.
No.
January 15th.
No, it's
we think of it as a long way away, but it is not. The first votes of the race for the nomination, January 15th. Mr. Trump's enduring popularity with the Republican base so strong that the former president has recently felt comfortable veering away from the party's orthodoxy on abortion is only one of Mr. DeSantis' major hurdles in Iowa. The other being people don't like him.
Hmm. Shocker. You know, 13 million. Think about that, Joe. I mean, the only thing you got to be able to watch on Iowa TV until next year is the hog belly and corn futures and DeSantis ads. Boy, it's not like Iowa's not a miserable place to begin with, but they're going to have nothing on TV.
Well, state assassinations here, but okay. But is $13 million in ads going to do anything, Terry?
Well, first, I just want to warn Bob to stay away from Iowa for a while.
Trust me, my wife's family's from there, so that's already a done deal.
Oh, all right. So that was a planned attack. I got it.
No family reunion next year. Sorry, go ahead, Terry.
No, it seems like, at least in terms of Iowa, that DeSantis is done. There is likability in politics is incredibly important, especially when you're running for president. And for reasons that none of us can really explain, Donald Trump remains extremely likable with his base and with a huge, significant base in Iowa. There's just something about the personality of DeSantis that just hasn't lit that enthusiasm, regardless of the fact that you got to give him credit for working hard. He certainly has been working extremely hard to get their votes, but when coming face to face with these voters on the retail political side, he just hasn't been able to deliver. And I don't think any type of commercials are going to change that. I think Trump is positioned to take Iowa in a landslide. I don't know what's going to happen after Iowa, because it is a kind of a really unique state in every way, as Bob described. Certainly not representative of the rest of the country, but the rest of the country on the political side does seem to be leaning towards Trump. So I don't see any signs that DeSantis has any staying power here in this game.
Joe, can I ask a question to the rest of the panel? What do you think about Trump taking a more moderate position on abortion and the union right? Is it too early? What do you think about that move?
I think it's really interesting. I hate to use the word brilliant in relationship to this person, but I think it is strategic. He has a history of making strategic messaging decisions. And if he's looking at the numbers and seeing that he can afford to lose some of these evangelicals and a trade-off to gain back support of some of the independents, maybe he believes it's something that's worth the risk.
He gets to he's got the bragging rights of the Supreme Court that overturned Roe v. Wade. And I think the most evangelicals, he'll be sure to remind them of that over and over. As far as, you know, the timing is concerned, you know, in terms of when an abortion is banned, I don't know that he gets a pass, but you know, they'll know that there's never going to be a national law on it, but he can always remind them, I fought for states' rights on this. And you know, they'll say, okay, all right, we can live with that.
I think one of the things in this country that always amazes me is that politics is not about policy discussions. It's about entertainment values. And DeSantis is just not capable of being authentic in his expressions or his articulations. He comes across as angry,
surly.
Surly, not he's just not fun.
Well, and, he know, is authentic. That's the DeSantis
that's
you
right.
get.
Except
he's a thug.
For that,
he's a
people
bully.
Think he's not like the real deal. Whereas a lot of people apparently think, you know, it's again mysterious to me that Trump walks around and he just says what he wants and he just says what comes to his head and he just articulates ideas as chaotic as they come to his brain, and that is fun. Yep. Because he doesn't have a filter, he doesn't have to contain or somehow you know, figure out how to say it differently. He just says it. And for a lot of people, that makes him authentic.
And it, and he does what, and he will do, I think, your point on unions. You know, he'll do what he's done his whole life, which his whole political career especially, is promise a solution.
His promises, right?
That's a nice way of saying it.
You know, he's gonna have a health care plan. I'm not going to tell you about it until I get elected. And then, of course, he didn't have one. And this is going to be, I could solve the union problem like that. I could solve Ukraine in 24 hours
but
like
will
that.
Will people believe it this time? Because, I mean, he's made those promises before. And honestly, I'm still waiting to figure out what he delivered to labor in his period of being president. I mean, what did he deliver to people that actually benefited them?
Yeah, I don't recall.
Yeah, I know. We're just all looking at each other going like,
Tax breaks to the CEOs.
The regular folks. They just love him speaking off the cuff and being rude and insulting, and it's a bit like wrestling, you know, entertainment.
So when does DeSantis drop out, Joe?
Well, I would assume after Iowa, right? I don't see any reason why you wouldn't do it. If you've got the money, you've got the money in reserve, and who knows? It is a quirky state. It's a weird state. God knows, the last one didn't go so well, if you remember, as far as it's not a primary, it's a caucus.
Right.
Most people don't even understand how it works. I've read 4 books on it, and I still don't completely understand how Iowa caucus works. So I don't know. I would assume maybe one more try for New Hampshire and then you're done, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't.
Unless he thinks he has a South Carolina in him, right? I mean, unless he thinks he's got a, you know, something like that.
Went to Florida.
He must, I don't even
know that he could win his home state, but in Florida?
Later.
I don't know. It's later on.
Good question.
Yeah, later.
Yeah.
Well, they also all keep hoping that something will come of these various indictments and trials that Trump is in the middle of, and that he might crash at some point. They're all waiting for that opening.
Yeah, and Trump is doing his damnedest to help him with that one, isn't he?
Yeah.
Well, it seems that way. You're absolutely right. And the other thing too is that as long as you have the money and you're waiting for the next court appearance, then yeah, I guess you can go on as long as you want to, as long as you've got the cash to do it.
But there's a point at which the donors are going to say,
absolutely,
this is not worth the investment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And my sense is that donors are already saying that to him. Is that the big money donors are pulling back from DeSantis.
Do you think he'd leave before Iowa?
No. Not at all. I think he'll take it a little too far because he's going to hope for that miracle that sort of what happened with Biden. If you think about, you know, Biden was on the ropes.
Oh, yeah.
And it would, you know, the turnaround in South Carolina. So he's going to try to take that as a opportunity or a playbook. But I think he's more like Scott Walker, you know, again, a popular governor within a niche area who is generally unlikable to the rest of the world.
And with that,
happy
we end
day.
Our time together. That's right. Thank you all for being with us. Wonderful to have you. Terry Gibson, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Jay Jachnowitz, Bob Griffin, Vera Karius-Kelly, thank you all for your insights this morning. Thanks to the listeners for your letters. We'll be back right after this.